24 from Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
It's always an exciting day when we can talk about one of the greatest players in the history of the NFL, and especially exciting when that player is a Green Bay Packer. We're going to be talking today on the morning show about the Packers' legendary quarterback, Brett Favre. Courtesy of a very insightful and thorough new biography called Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre. The author of this book is Jeff Perlman, who is a best-selling author of a number of different works, including Showtime, Magic Kareem Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers dynasty of the 1980s. He also wrote a much-discussed biography of Chicago Bears running back Walter Payton and many other intriguing books. This latest book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You may have seen it excerpted in Sports Illustrated magazine. I have read it cover to cover and found it so interesting and exciting. And I'm really, really grateful for this opportunity to speak with its author, Jeff Perlman. The title again, Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre. Jeff Perlman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. And I just want to say we're making history because this is the first time I've done an interview while walking my dog.
Ah, well, we hope you and your dog will enjoy the next few minutes very, very much. You say something really interesting in the preface or foreword or whatever it is at the start of your book, the prologue, I guess, about celebrities. And you say we will have relatively brief encounters with celebrities and then we presume to know them. And, of course, that's a mistake that we make again and again. And, of course, plenty of Packers fans and even fans who are not fans of the Packers have probably made that mistake time and time again with a figure like Brett Favre. In what way were you trying to, in a sense, sort of undo the simplistic assumptions that people have made about Brett Favre over the years?
Well, I just find it's kind of funny. When I started my career at Sports Illustrated, I would meet a famous person, and I would interview him for 10 minutes, major league ball player. And then someone, I was young and kind of dumb, and someone would be like, what's Torrey Hunter like? Oh, he's the best. He's great, blah, blah, blah. And you don't really know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I had 10-minute interaction with Torrey Hunter. You can have 2 hours with Torrey Hunter. You don't know. So it's not like I was trying to – I certainly wasn't trying to, like, put a, you know, pop the balloon of mythology around Brett Favre. But I just find him potentially – I found him potentially really fascinating. You know, the whole Mississippi upbringing. The relationship with his parents, the addiction issues, and sort of how he dealt with them. And it just drives me crazy when we tell the same 5 stories over and over again about people, and especially iconic sort of people, important people in sports history in this case. So I just wanted to really get in and sort of see who this guy really was.
You spoke to all kinds of different people about Brett Favre. You actually ended up not speaking with Brett Favre directly, but it's interesting. We have no sense of that being much of a loss in that, I mean, what is said about him is so rich and so varied. First of all, how many people did you end up talking to? I mean, did you keep count? Was it dozens, hundreds, thousands? And how much do you regret that among those many people you spoke to, Brett Favre himself was not among them?
I end up interviewing 573 people. Exactly.
Wow.
And the reason I know the total is because it becomes like a collection to me and like a badge of honor. You know, like when I read, when I go in the bookstore and I look at other biographies, which I do a lot, and I'll go to the back and I'll see maybe they'll list the interviews or they'll, in the acknowledgments, they'll say who they talked to. And I see they talked to 60 people or 80 people. It always angers me in a weird way. Because I just think that's not, you can't do that. Like, that means you're relying on regurgitated sources mainly. And that means you're going with, you know, material that's, you know, already been published as your primary way of learning about someone. And it just seems like the worst way to learn about someone. You know, my dad used to say, you can really judge people. It's not the first to say it, but most people I've been treating, they don't have to be nice to you. Hmm. I thought was going to be nice to Mike Holmgren because he was his coach, and he was going to be nice to Bob Harlan because he was, you know, basically signing his paychecks. I really love talking to this free agent running back from Bucknell who's in camp with the Packers for a month. You know, I love talking with, like, I found the woman who sold him his house in Green Bay. I found the priest who was with him when his father did. You know, people like that are the real crux of a biography because they really show you what the interactions were and how he treated people and who he was off the field.
Hmm. The way Brett Favre treated the ordinary people in his life, and of course it's also those ordinary people who tend not to be included in such accounts. I really appreciate the fact that the testimony of people like this are as important a part of this book as the famous people who are also here. You tell two stories about Brett Favre in the prologue that you say are two of your favorite stories about him, and I suspect that the reason you include them is because they show us two very different sides of Brett Favre, albeit both stories involving his interaction with two different little boys. Do you want to just say a little word about these two stories and what they say about who Brett Favre was and remains?
Oh, yeah. As soon as I got him, I thought, man, these are so good. The first was there was an assistant coach of the Packers who was there very briefly, and he had a son named Javi. And they moved they lived down the street from Brett. And Brett was, he was just great with kids and really fun. You know, that was sort of his thing. He was just this fun guy. And he, one day he said to Javi, hey, Javi, we're buddies, right? And Javi's like, yeah, Brett, buddies. And Brett goes, you probably don't know this, but buddies have their own secret handshake or their own secret hand signals. Ah, okay, Brett. All right, so Javi, I'm going to teach you a hand signal, but it's just for you and me, okay? Okay, Brett. Okay, first, Javi, you take your fist. Okay, Brett, I got my fist. And then you only stick up the middle finger. Okay, Brett. And then whenever I drive by or whenever you see me, you give me our secret hand signal, okay? Okay, Brett. So whenever Brett would drive by, little Javi, age four or whatever, would be running at him with his finger, middle finger in the air. I just love that story. I mean, it's so him. And then the other one is there was a wonderful woman, Michelle, whose son Anderson had a very bad form of cancer. He was young, he was only two, and he loved Brett Favre. And Favre paid a visit to him, flew to his home with Deanna, his wife, to visit him. And this kid could only, by the end of his life, I think near the end of his life, he could only get trouble drawing numbers and letters the right way. And he would draw, he made pictures for Brett of him wearing his Vikings uniform, but he made the number four backwards. And Brett started a game against the Bears, and after the game, all the questions were asked, and someone asked him why on the towel dangling from his uniform he had number four written backwards. I just love that. Mm. I love that. I get chills thinking about that.
Right, and it was a tribute to this brave little boy. And I really love the quote you include from this little boy's mother, who says, lots of people have heroes, but to know your hero loves you as much as you love him. That's special. And of course, that is the kind of relationship that would spring up between Brett Favre and one of these young children. And it wasn't just this one relationship. I mean, that would play out again and again. And we would see over and over how Brett Favre for all his toughness as a football player and maybe brashness and rawness in terms of personality, had this tremendously sensitive, soft heart full of compassion for these children battling these brutal diseases.
He just said, you know what? He it's funny. People are like, I don't want to read your book and hate Brett Favre. And I kind of feel like, I don't know how you can read this book. I'm not saying because of anything. I did just who he is. And now love Brett Favre. Like, I just think dogs are real, and he deals with them. He's done a lot of dumb things, and he acknowledges it. But he's really real, and he's sincere, and he wants to do well. That's the thing. He's not a guy who went out drinking and then felt great about it the next day. You know, like, he has this real profound Catholic guilt to him. It's like a recurring theme with people I talk to. He would do things and feel horrible about it. It's not like he would do things. He just sometimes couldn't get out of his own way. And when it came to other people, he was insanely good with writing people back, charitable events, showing up. There was a guy who worked for the Packers, Leo Yell, who was a special needs employee. The Packers threw I think it was his 40th birthday, and they threw a 40th birthday party for Leo Yell. One player showed up. One. Brett Favre. They all knew the guy. One showed up, Brett Favre. There is so much goodness to that man. I really mean this. It really is. He went through a lot of rocky roads. There was a ton of goodness.
We're speaking with Jeff Perlman about his newly published biography of Brett Favre called Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre. I really appreciated the front end of this biography as you help us understand the amazing family in which he was raised down in the heart of Mississippi, particularly his father Irvin and his mother Benita and his various siblings. One intriguing thing you say is that it made a real difference that they grew up, that is, the Favre children grew up in geographic isolation. Explain what kind of a difference that made in terms of sort of the life that they had and the relationship they had with one another.
Well, it's really funny. When you drive there, you can read about where he grew up, but to actually see it is pretty striking. I mean, I'm a guy from New York. I used to go into the city all the time. You know, there were neighbors 40 feet away. And, you know, you go to where he lives, and there's a road, Irvin Favre Road. It's Favre misspelled, you know, and it's all these homes on it spread apart with Favre family members. And there's a gate code you have to get in. You know, they didn't grow up where, like, your neighbors is away. So they just, Brett, his two brothers, his younger sister, cousins, they just basically beat the crap out of each other. You know, and they would play Kill the Carrier, and they would rip the head off of Brandy dolls and play baseball with them, and they would shoot BB guns, and, you know, it was look out for the alligators. It was this really sort of innocent, joyful way of growing up. And you know, Irv used to say, you're either in or you're out. Meaning, if you're going to be in and watch TV, you go inside. But otherwise, you're outside playing all day. And these guys always chose out. It's like you don't find – it's sad because you just don't see that anymore, especially with phones and iPads. Like, these kids were outside all the time. And I live in Southern California where youth sports are so hyper-managed. It's insane. And basically, Brett Favre became a great athlete because he would tell his brothers to go long, you know, and because he'd drop back the pass, and maybe his older brother Scott would beat the snot out of him, you know, and drop him to the ground. Like, that's how he learned to be an athlete, the old-fashioned way, where you play it and enjoy it. And if you want to know where the joy comes from, that's where it comes from, the joy of your backyard, the joy of running around in a ripped pair of jeans, slamming your knee into a rock, getting back up, you're bleeding a little, but that's okay. And, you know, your dad whistling you in for supper.
Right.
That was his childhood.
And I really loved a quote of, let's see, that would be his brother Jeff, I think, who said something about as far as he was concerned, it was no secret why the state of Mississippi turned out so many great athletes. And he said it had something to do with growing up in an environment like that that really stoked a young person's creativity. Say more about that and how that was true for Brett Favre.
First of all, I love how you picked out that quote, because when he said it, I was sitting in a bar with him in Erie, Pennsylvania. As soon as he said that, I thought, wow, that's great. Because I wrote a book about Walter Payton, and basically have Walter Payton, Jerry Rice, and Brett Favre, all from Mississippi. You can make an argument that the greatest wide receiver, the greatest running back, and the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL all come from the same small state. And he was right. Like, Walter Payton is the same thing. All right, Mom, I'm going out. All right, we'll see you later. And you wouldn't see him until dark, you know, and it wasn't, part of it was the time period. There were not, again, there weren't, you know, 700 channels and there wasn't an iPhone in your hand. But a lot of it was like, just go have fun, go play, get your chores done and go out there and, you know, try not to rip your jeans and go beat the crap out of each other. And it was really like I grew up, I grew up with a nervous Jewish mother, right? You know, are you okay? Are you going to be okay? Are you okay? These guys grew up with, like, just go out there. If Brett would, you know, bang his knee or slam his head into something, you're okay. Go back out there. You're okay. You know, that's where the toughness comes from. You're fine. You're fine. Just go back out there. Same with Walter Payton. You're okay. Just get out there. You know, there wasn't the coddling. There was no coddling.
Right.
You're fine. Just get out there. And that goes a long way. That really does. That's an underrated device in parenting. You are fine. Get back up. You're fine.
And, of course, this matter of also making do with having nothing on hand. Jeff said that you make use of what you have, and that brings out the creativity. That's what allows you to overcome things. You don't have a ball. You don't say we can't play ball. Make a ball. Take a piece of paper, crumple it up. Take another piece of paper, or take a sock, rack it up with electric tape, with duct tape, whatever you have to do. If you want to play, you'll find a way to make it happen. Brett Favre, of course, eventually is out on the football field and eventually coached by his father. Ironically, although it was always the Favre boys who served as quarterback for Irv Favre's teams, he was not a coach enamored with throwing the ball. So Brett Favre, although he had this incredibly strong arm, really didn't get to show his stuff out on the football field very often at all as a high school player. Talk about that.
It's funny. In many ways, it sort of points to a flaw in his dad that he didn't recognize what he had. You know, kid had a nuclear arm and he threw four times a game. His dad was just a old school, run the ball down your throats sort of guy. And he also happened to have a great running back. I mean, this guy named Charles Burton, he was fantastic. So Brett would never throw the ball. He wanted to. Dad, can we throw the ball? Shut up. Dad, how about now? Shut up. You know, he wanted to, but he would never allow to. So he missed his sophomore year with mono, and then junior and senior year, he played and never threw the ball. And, you know, there were some college recruiters coming to see the running back, Charles Burton. He was undersized, though, so it wasn't going to happen. But nobody was coming to see Brett Favre. Nobody, I mean, again, why would you want a quarterback who doesn't throw? And there was a recruiter for Southern Miss named Mark McHale. He was an assistant coach. He had just been hired late, and his turf was a golf. And he didn't know anything. He didn't know anything about the area. He'd never been to the area. And he starts asking around because, again, he's late to the game. And someone says to him, I don't know, there's this kid down by Hancock. He never throws the ball. But I saw him warming up. Jesus Christ, can he throw? So McHale calls Irv. I want to come down and see your son. And Irv is just euphoric. He's, you want to see my son? Okay. And Mark comes down and he meets Irv and he meets Brett briefly by the car. And Irv says, come to the game this weekend. I'll have Brett throw it. And he comes to the game and Brett throws the ball like four times. And after the game, Irv is like, so what do you think? And McHale's like, I can't do anything with this. You told me he was going to throw. He didn't throw. Ah, all right. I'll tell you what. Come to the next game.
Hello? Right. Oh, and then you'll finally get to see him. Hello?
Yeah. And then, can you hear me? Hello?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Did I break down for you there?
It was silent for just a second. Now you're okay. Go ahead.
Oh. So, you know, I moved to a much better area. I'll go upstairs. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So, yeah, sorry to screw that up for you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, basically, Irv is, McHale says, I need to grow. So Irv says, come back for the next game. He comes back for the next game, and he still doesn't throw. But he has one pass. I think it was one pass. It was like a 60-yarder with zip on it. And McHale just likes his moxie, and he likes talking to the kid, and he thinks there's something about him. And he also plays safety. So worst-case scenario, he plays safety. And Jim Carmody was a coach at Southern Miss, and they had one scholarship left, and Carmody wasn't sold. But on the last day, someone backed out from the state of Georgia, and they gave Favre a scholarship. And that's the only reason he was able to play college football, is he kind of lucked into it.
Hmm. At this point, I think it would be good for us to talk about something else that made the whole Favre family a bit exceptional when it came to the typical family in the state of Mississippi in this period. And that is, at least to a large extent, how colorblind the Favres were, including Brett's father, Irv, who refused to make any coaching decisions with preference for race at all. Talk about just how exceptional this was. That is, for this Favre family to reach out as openly as they did, for instance, to blacks in the community. I mean, just how uncommon was that in this time and place?
Right, so I would not say they were colorblind, just to be clear. And what I mean by that is it still would have been unacceptable at that time for Brett to have a black girlfriend, just in the cultural norms of Mississippi. I think that would not have flown over. And they would admit that. I mean, I talked to them about that. You know, it would have been now not a big deal. In fact, now there are biracial kids in the Favre family. But back then, it would have been tough. But what was interesting is she kind of had two things. Bonita Favre, Brett's mother, was a special education teacher, and she would take her kids to the class to interact with her kids. So they developed a real sense of empathy and understanding, and that was on purpose. That was by design. And Irv, like you said, you would never, use race as a factor. I mean, in how to play players or how to treat players. I mean, never, never, never. And these guys, you know, Charles Burton, the halfback I mentioned, he used to come over, sleep over at the Favre house, eat dinner at the house, watch movies. It just wasn't a factor in who they were friends with. All these guys, some of their best friends, were different races. It just wasn't an issue. And then when Brett ended up in the NFL, you know, there is a lot of, in professional sports locker rooms, there's definitely a lot of segregation, silent segregation, where one guy goes here. I mean, one group is over there and one group is over there. I mean, Brett, his favorite movie was New Jack City. He knew all the words to Rapper's Delight. He was a huge Tupac fan. At the same time, he would go hunting with the white guys from Kentucky. And he just, you know, you can trace that straight to his background. He was used to being with different people of different ethnicities. It wasn't a thing to him.
It was interesting when he finally arrived at Southern Mississippi, where he went to college, that he was still largely unheralded, largely unknown, and rather far down the depth chart, as they say. And especially early on, a lot of his time there was very, very up and down. I think at one point you said something about how he was a different player from practice to practice, from game to game, this incredibly strong arm, but a real lack of touch. Was that in part because he had, in game situations, thrown so little? Or are we talking about something else that was, I mean, in a sense, more fundamental beyond just his relative inexperience?
No, I think the number one problem was he had a nuclear arm, but he didn't know how to use it. Yeah, it definitely doesn't help if you're throwing four times a game versus 20. You know, you don't really get, you know, that's how you develop touch, is by practice and touch. And even in practices, he wasn't throwing much. So, and he also, you know, you're a young kid blessed with, and you're given a nuclear weapon for an arm. You like using it. So there are a million stories at Southern Miss about him just like, you know, there's one legendary, he threw a pass to a receiver and the receiver turned at the last second and caught it. And after the game, someone asked him, how did you know that ball was coming? And his response, and he was 100% serious, was, I heard it. He was like, you heard it? And he said, you can hear the whistle of the ball coming toward you. And that's a recurring theme. I usually don't buy stuff like that. I truly don't. When people say, like, I've only heard two guys hit a baseball like that, I always think, oh, okay, whatever. But the whistling football thing is a recurring theme with Brett Favre. When you talk to people, they say, that ball, when he threw it super hard, would make a whistling sound, a very distinguishable whistling sound in the air. And I think he loved that. You know, he loved being able to cock back his arm and just let it fire away.
It's during his time at Southern Mississippi that Brett Favre, who was, you say, for the most part at least, a non-drinker in high school, begins drinking for the first time, and of course this becomes quite a theme in his life. I was surprised not long after you said that to read that he actually grew up around alcohol. He saw alcohol all the time. So he had an interesting relationship with it early on. That is, as a high school student, not himself drinking, but seeing a lot of drinking. Can you talk more about Brett Favre's kind of complicated relationship with alcohol and how significant a problem it turned out to be for him during his collegiate years?
Well, he, like you said, he didn't drink through high school. And he grew up in a family and in a culture, you know, in the Deep South there, where beer was everywhere. So, you know, the adults are having dinner, beer, having a party, beer. We're watching a game, let's have a beer. It was just always there. And Irv, his dad, definitely drank too much, and without question drank too much, and was never diagnosed with alcoholism, but I think it's pretty clear he was a problem drinker. Brett, like many of us, myself included, actually never really drank until college, and he took to it quickly. It's actually a funny story. The first game he played in was the second game of his freshman year against Tulane, and he was the third quarterback on the depth chart by then, and he knew he wasn't going to play. So the night before the game, he and his roommate, a guy named Chris Riles, they went out and they bought a case and a half of Schlitz beer, and they split it. So the morning of the game, Favre is vomiting, you know, in the corner of the field. And at halftime, he finds out he's going into the game against Tulane. You know, and the guy is, like, green and the smell of vomit on his breath. And he goes in and, you know, he wins the game for 7 minutes. He drank a ton. He got in a lot of fights, a lot of bar fights. A couple of times was picked up by police. Somehow, I don't know how, he was able to, I remember college drinking too much and not being able to walk the next day. And here's Brett Favre. He had a high threshold. He could drink a lot and then he could play at a high level. And what happened, though, ultimately his senior year, before senior year of college, he had a really bad car accident where he was drinking and skidded off the road. Car flipped. He almost died. He lost 30 inches of his intestine and missed the first game of the season. I'd say that was the first moment where alcohol played a very negative impact in his life. But it took him a long time to sort of become a non-drinker.
It, of course, is during his college years that he first meets the woman who would become his wife, Deanna. I think it's fair to say that probably for people who love Brett Favre and are huge fans of his, probably one of the revelations in your book that is probably most painful to encounter is to read of the way in which, at least from time to time, he treated Deanna and treated their first daughter after she was born. Can you say a word about that, and also maybe a word about what it felt like for you as the author to share about this? I suspect, as someone who ultimately really admires Brett Favre, that this was hard to write about.
Yeah, so he actually met her in high school. They were a high school sweetheart, so to speak.
Oh, that's right.
And and she got pregnant very early. She got pregnant when he was in college. He wasn't ready to be a dad. I mean, who in college would be? He wasn't ready. He wasn't emotionally there. He wanted to be a good dad and he wanted to be involved, but he wasn't capable. And through the years, we always say, it's funny, I've had this conversation a lot. I always think it's a mistake. I mean, sometimes it happens, but to marry the first person you fall in love with and the first person, to be honest, to be blunt, that you have sex with, I feel like you're always wondering what's out there. And what could have been, and what am I missing in my life, you know? And like, so you're Brett Favre, and here's the first girl you're intimate with, the first girl you kiss, and she becomes the woman you're attached to. And I do think there's this like, well, what else is out there? Life is a candy store. I'm a superstar. I could sleep with anyone I want. I could do whatever I want. And he took advantage of that. And it sucks. It actually sucks. And writing this book, I developed an incredible amount of empathy and heartache, maybe is the right word, for Deanna, because she's this religious girl from Mississippi. She falls in love with this guy. He is good, just good enough to her that she stays, but he's awful enough to her that you cringe and it's painful how bad he was, and the infidelity, the drug addiction, the drinking. He was really bad to her for a long time, and she was the one who presented him to the Hall of Fame. And it was really, I couldn't think of a better choice, because the thing that she did that was really important is she talked to him, and she was pretty insistent that he needed to shed some of the hang-ons in his life, that he needed to stop. Some of these people were really bringing him down, and that caused a lot of people to dislike her. She's a tough woman, but she was right, and she kind of saved him.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jeff Perlman about his book, Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre. One of the great crushing disappointments of his life was the fact that he was not drafted to the NFL in the first round. He was not picked up until the second round and picked up by the Atlanta Falcons. Why did that happen, in your opinion? Why did he not go in the first round?
Car accident the senior year, really. He wasn't that great his senior year because he was playing, he's 30 pounds underweight when the season started. He never had his full strength. They were not a great team that year because he was clearly the best quarterback in that draft. I mean, the two guys picked ahead of him, Dan McGuire by Seattle, who's Mark McGuire's brother. He was 6'8", but didn't have his beyond strength and depth. And then Todd Marinovich, who was a known drug addict, like for the Raiders. And Favre is, incredulous. How the hell is this happening to me? And even when he was drafted, the Falcons really wanted Browning Nagel from Louisville. The coach, Jerry Glanville, wanted Browning Nagel, and the GM wanted Favre. So they took Favre and Nagel and next to the Jets and kind of busted. He just was a shell of his former self his senior year, and that scared off a lot of people.
Hmm. It is really interesting to look at this year with the Atlanta Falcons, and you begin that chapter of the book by saying that, in your estimation, the single most fascinating year of Brett Favre's football career was this year with the Atlanta Falcons. And yet it's a year that almost nobody talks about, or talks about only very, very briefly without examining it. So, first of all, why do you say that this year with the Atlanta Falcons, a rather miserable year for Brett Favre, was also in so many ways a really fascinating period in his life and career?
Well, nobody knows about it, first of all. It's like everyone knows he played for the Falcons, and that's about it. Even in his own, he wrote an autobiography back after they won the Super Bowl, and he devotes 9 paragraphs to the Falcons, including 2 of those paragraphs are single sentences. So nobody talks about it. And he's this kid, and he shows up, and coach has no interest in him, just called him Mississippi all year. Hey, Mississippi, what the hell is wrong with you? And Favre was third string most of the year. He was behind Chris Miller and Billy Joe Tolliver. So he never played. He basically went out and got drunk and fat. And he showed up for meetings with help on his breath. He was sent home a couple of times. Landville said he went to the different bars in Atlanta and told them not to serve him. He went to a popular crowd because he was drinking too much. Missed the team picture. Showed up late. Said, I got stuck behind a train wreck. Landville said, you are the train wreck. He finally plays in the game late in the year. His coach said at one point Landville was asked, what it would take for Favre to play. And his response was a plane crash. And he put the entire team on it. He finally gets into a game late in the year. It's a blowout, but getting killed by the Redskins or RFK. And his first pass as a professional, he drops back, overthrows Mike Pritchard. Andre Collins intercepts it, returns it for a touchdown. Favre jogs over to the sideline and he says, you got something, coach. And I was like, what? He goes, my first NFL pass, and I throw a touchdown. And I was like, yeah, you threw it to the wrong team. Yeah, that's okay. And, by the end of that season, I mean, Glanville wanted nothing to do with Favre. And, Glanville has gotten sort of criticized over the years for trading Favre. And how could you trade this guy who goes on to be a legend? I think it would be the equivalent of someone having traded Johnny Manziel after his first season in Cleveland, where you're like, this is really going to be worth the headache. There's no way he could have known what Favre would become, and I don't even think Favre would have become what he became had he just stayed in Atlanta.
He couldn't have become who he was in that kind of environment. I think one thing that's really interesting is that the scout or assistant coach, I don't remember, I think his last name was Herrick, something like that, but was a real champion for Favre. And you describe how heartbreaking it was for him to see Favre struggle and fail again and again to show proper interest, and just again and again being a disappointment in so many different ways. It just kind of reminds you that this is not only a business but a very personal enterprise as well. And those kind of disappointments when somebody, in a sense, lets you down can be incredibly painful.
Well, the thing that it was the general manager, Kenny Herrick. He was a guy, Glanville wanted Nagel, Herrick insisted on Favre. And the problem was he couldn't really, when Glanville came at the end of the year and said, you got to trade this guy, he couldn't really argue. Because as much as he believed in Favre and his talent was off the charts, he saw it, and the guy did get drunk and fat his rookie year, and he wasn't working hard, and he was a disaster. So, you know, when he was able to get a first-round pick from the Green Bay Packers, I mean, Glanville was like, holy praise Jesus, this is the best trade ever. First-round pick for that guy? This is amazing. So, again, it wouldn't have happened for Favre in Atlanta. So I kind of think that the criticism isn't really warranted. It just would not have worked.
Hmm. So tell us what it was about Green Bay and the Green Bay Packers that made it, in a sense, such a match made in heaven. I mean, what was it about the team, their coach, the town? What was most significant in making it the situation in which Brett Favre could finally, in a sense, show his magic?
Well, it was a few things. Number one, they had a new general manager, Ron Wolf. When Wolf was hired, he took stock of the Packers roster and he thought it was pretty much a joke. He was filled with guys he would have never had on a football team. And he wanted a quarterback, and he wanted to draft Favre when he was at the Jets and missed him by one. In fact, he was on the phone with Favre because the Jets had to pick after the Falcons. He was on the phone with Favre telling him, if Atlanta doesn't take you here, we're going to grab you. And then Favre hears a click on the line, and it's the Falcons. So Wolf really wanted it from the beginning. And he's hired, and he sees what the team has. And, you know, the starting quarterback is Don Majkowski. A couple years earlier, he'd been a Pro Bowler, a good player, a magic man. But he was reduced by this point. So Wolf acquires Favre for the first-round pick. And he really just shows up. Number one, it's a city or a town that is longing for good times again. Number two, it's a quarterback. Like, Atlanta had Chris Miller as a starter. And Chris Miller is a really good quarterback. Don Majkowski was not a really good quarterback at this point. So it was a place where the starter was not going to be the starter forever. And he also was blessed with, and people don't talk about this enough, he walked into a situation where he has Sterling Sharp as a wide receiver. And Sterling Sharp was a pain in the butt, but he was an insanely gifted player. So when Favre finally, when he entered, Majkowski gets hurt. First, he plays a little against Tampa Bay, doesn't play that well. But then the next week against Cincinnati, Majkowski gets hurt. Favre comes on, and he just really lights it up. And he didn't play well at first, but at the end, he just lit it up, through the famous touchdown pass to win the game. And he was kind of magical. And he was kind of, he had this huge arm that Majkowski didn't have. And he had this sort of chutzpah that Majkowski no longer had. He was willing to take risks. And he knew if he threw it up to Sharp, Sharp would take care of him. So it just was really a great, ideal sort of moment situation for Favre to emerge.
In the 14th chapter of your book, titled The Wheels Fall Off, you chronicle what most Packer fans can sort of guess you're talking about from that title, when in 1994 some of Brett Favre's off-field practices begin to really catch up with him in a serious way. One of the things that you say in this chapter that was really interesting to me is, in a sense, the way in which the press failed to cover this facet of Brett Favre's story. And you say it was really because of the team and what the message that the team was sending to journalists about what would happen if they covered this aspect of Brett Favre's story. Describe what I'm talking about.
Well, I think it's a combination, actually. I think it's again, I'm a New Yorker, and in New York, the newspapers go for blood because you have so many of them competing against each other. So just the Daily News and the Post alone is a heated rivalry. And then you get the Times and Newsday and the different Staten Island, all the different papers. And it's hardcore. And Green Bay is not that way. And also the Packers are a publicly owned team, and the fan base in Green Bay feels, they feel a connection to the team that play people in other cities just don't have. I mean, they own the team in part. So, you know, part of it was the media, I think, you know, like they knew, I mean, there were whispers and gossips and sightings all the time of Brett Favre with women, Brett Favre drunk. And I think there was an awareness among sports editors and reporters that fans probably didn't really want to read about this, and maybe they should just focus on football. And at the same time, the Packers made it clear that this is not something we want you to write about, you know. And if you're a writer, if you're a beat writer, or if you're a columnist, access is important, and that's all you have is access. And the threat of that access being taken away goes a long way. And there's a long history of in sports of the denial of access being used as a dangling carrot to why to or not to write about something. And that was sort of the thing in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the Packers.
Right. So you describe this abyss in which Brett Favre slowly descends, in which he becomes addicted to painkillers. And it gets so bad that he goes to his wife, Deanna, one day with a very, very strange request. I'd never heard this story before. And as I read this, I realized, oh, my gosh, that's what it means to be addicted to painkillers. Can you tell listeners what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, and he did this with the, first of all, he was getting painkillers from teammates. He was getting painkillers from the teams. He was getting painkillers from any way possible. And he was getting Deanna, you know, he asked Deanna when she went to, I think it was her dentist, to get, you know, painkillers. So, and that's when you're really like, oh, my God. And there was a, you know, they went to the ESPYs one time. And they're sitting at a table. And Brett excuses himself to go to the bathroom, and he's gone for an hour. And he was gone in the bathroom taking 13 Vicodin. You know, he would be staying up all night, you know, high off of the kick of the Vicodin and the chaser. And he, you know, he ended up having a seizure. He was in the hospital for just a procedure. And that's sort of what they, you know, NFL doctors demanded that he go to rehab. And he went to the Menninger's clinic. But he was, yeah, he was a... You know, it started, his mom said to me, she thinks she got the case for it after his injury, his car accident in college when he had the morphine pump by his side in the hospital. And then he first had Vicodin, he first took Vicodin in 1992 after taking a vicious hit against the Eagles. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And it's a toughie. NFL, a man is not naturally born to play professional football, especially for that long of a period, and they take that sort of beating. So, you know, from that era, the number of guys who did not use some sort of painkiller. Very, very few.
Right. You say, actually, at one point, against conventional logic, Brett Favre, drug addict, was a significantly better football player than Brett Favre, mere beer drinker. But, of course, at some point, the addiction became so serious that something had to happen. And, of course, anybody who follows the NFL remembers that dramatic moment when Brett Favre stepped forward to admit this problem and to seek help for it. You were clearly impressed with the way that Brett Favre handled this difficult moment in his life.
Well, I mean, he didn't want to do... initially, it was the Packers who pushed him to the press conference. And funny, I talked to one guy. I forgot which player it was. Darius Holland, maybe, who was so turned off by it and said he kind of lost trust for the team at that point because they basically put Favre out there and exposed him. And they didn't have to. He did not have to publicly say he had this problem, but he did. And he handled it very, very well. And he was very honest about it and very open about it. It's a thing. He learned something. Like, I covered baseball for a long time in Sports Illustrated, and they were like, Alex Rodriguez was the least sportsman guy ever. And it kind of bit him. People no longer trusted him. They never thought he was being sincere. Favre never had that problem. Sincerity was never an issue with Favre. He was open. He was honest. He admitted his flaws. And there's a lesson in that. People respond to that. You just say, you know what, I screwed up. I'm messing this up. I'm no good. I need help. It goes a lot longer than just pretending that everything's okay. It got a lot farther. It actually really works out, and it did for him.
Of course, one of the things you also had to write about is Brett Favre retiring, unretiring. You paint a picture in which that move in some respects was surprising and in some respects not surprising at all.
Yeah. He actually just, as you were asking that question, he just retired and unretired four more times. 20 seconds he took. Wait, he just unretired. He's good. yeah, you know, it was like a, it's a weird thing, right? He, first of all, there wasn't really a decline in his skill. And that's a toughie. Because usually what leads a player to decline leads a player to retire is a decline in his skill. He just, at some point, it becomes clear he can't do it anymore. Well, Favre never had that. A little bit his last year with the Vikings, and then he did retire. But for all those seasons, he never had that. 2 decades, high level. And he wanted, so that's hard. There wasn't an obvious ending. And the other thing is he just, you know, you want to be loved, and you want to be appreciated. And he clearly enjoyed the, no, Brett, don't go. Well, I don't know. Please, Brett, don't go. All right, I won't go. Yay, we love you, Brett. And when the Packers took that away, and the Packers basically said, when he retired after 2007, and it was clear he was retired, and he had the press conference, he was crying, and it was very emotional, the Packers moved on, clearly and rightly. They did move on, and they had a quarterback ready, and that was okay. And then he said, no, I think I'm going to come back. And their reaction is sort of like, no, I don't know. Definitely not. You're not coming back. And there was a lot of back and forth, and he wanted to be traded, if he was going to be traded, to the Vikings or the Lions or the Bears. And the Packers said no and no and no. And he ended up going to the Jets. And then at the end of that year, he said, yeah, I might retire. And then he didn't. And then he went to the Vikings. And then at the end of that year, he said he was probably retired. And then he didn't. And then at the end of the next year, he said he was retired. And he thought he was retired. And his brother told me something interesting, Scott. He said he thinks Brett needed that final year of getting his butt kicked after being on a really bad team in a really bad situation. But he needed that as a sort of push out the door.
Mm.
You know, like, gets over for you. This is it.
Right.
He walked away.
To be that miserable on the field. Up to that point, he had still loved the game so much. Ultimately,
well, I think he loved the game. I think he loved the game that last season. I just think he couldn't do it anymore. And his team was terrible. And his career ended with a concussion. And there's nothing worse than, like, you know, he gets up against the Bears, his head is slammed into the turf. And he's like, why are the Chicago Bears here? And it was just so depressing, and that was kind of the end for him.
Wow. Well, ultimately, of course, Packer fans, at least to some extent, forgave him. And, of course, he has been back to Lambeau Field on more than one occasion and hailed as a conquering hero. And quite unexpectedly, even he and Aaron Rodgers, bitter rivals for a time, have at least to some extent mended some fences. So in many respects, this story has for the most part, ended quite triumphantly for Brett Favre.
Oh, it's great. I mean, he's 47. He's got his money. He actually has his health. He does triathlons. He runs races. He's a grandfather of two. He's done something really smart, too, I have to say. I thought about this the other day. A lot of athletes, when they retire, they go straight to the couch and the bag of extra large Doritos. And they sit there and they get fat and they get lonely and they get depressed and they start losing sort of what they had. He did that for a very brief period of time. He retired. He gained weight. He decided, I don't want to do it. He ran a 5K and was embarrassed by his time. And now he's in great shape and he's a runner. And, you know, he hunts and fishes and he's got a really good thing going. So it's been kind of nice and surprising. You think a guy who took that many hits would be, you know, using a walker right now, but he's in great shape.
Well, we can learn much, much more about this amazing man, this amazing athlete, and his incredible story in your book, Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author, Jeff Perlman. Jeff Perlman, congratulations on a superb book. You did this job really, really well. A challenging story. You tell it so thoroughly and persuasively, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes.
And that was a very enjoyable interview. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my interview with Colin O'Mara, who is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We will find out about his organization, its long history, celebrating its, I believe, 70th anniversary this year, and also find out about his concerns about the near future as his organization tries to do its work under the